You mentioned resources. Obviously, one of the things that powers redevelopment is money. I mean, businesses being willing to invest in housing and in jobs. And you write a lot about the importance, how important it was or would have been to do more of training for jobs to make a revitalized community viable. Do you, would you, some people would say that there's a built-in conflict between the potential for profits and the goals that you say should be the way this project is judged. Do you see it that way?
I don't know if it's such a potential for conflict or if it's just that we have to rethink what equity really means. Equity means people who are in need can access some resources, and that those who don't need as much shouldn't have access to as much, right? That's what equity is. Those in need get, those who don't need, they don't need to access because they already have. That's what equity, that's why we don't use equality when we use equity. So I don't really see the conflict, because what we say when we talk about equitable development and sustainability for the long haul is that those who need must be able to access it. And the reason that I talk about this project being one that's not equitable is because it didn't come in preparing the community to prosper, as the words and the rhetoric has continually offered. If the project was really going to offer jobs that the supposed bioscience park would have brought, it would have looked to find out how that workforce within the community could be actually affected and benefit from those jobs. But that didn't occur. No, the workforce wasn't prepared. And so what you have now in this current year and last year was, when asked and prodded, well, why aren't there more than 10% higher of local residents into construction jobs? For, let's just use construction as an example. What you hear from the politicians and from the people affiliated with this project is that the workforce is not qualified for it. Well, that's true. The workforce isn't qualified for it. And so if we're really about having this workforce, this particular potential workforce benefit, we would have figured out how to get that workforce qualified. But that didn't occur. And we don't tend to do that when we talk about rebuilding. We don't tend to look at community and have them have input and decision making. If you talk to the community and listen to the community, they'll tell you, we're not qualified for those jobs that are coming in. That just that itself would prompt the next question. Oh, really? Well, how do we do that? Well, maybe we need to put some resources in, as they say, upstream, so we can get that workforce qualified or make it that it's a workforce for that rebuilding project. But something like that didn't occur. That process benefits not just the community, but it benefits the developer and the people building there, because it brings jobs for the community. The community doesn't see this developer coming in as this, this giant that's just coming in to take their land and not bring something to share. Because this is the perception in East Baltimore, is this is another expansion of Hopkins and people and others like it that just continue to gobble up the land while people are continuously displaced further and further out. What you continue to have is this separation that doesn't come any closer. There are no steps to bring these two communities closer together. We just keep separating. We just keep separating. And instead of figuring out how we can bring these two communities closer together, we build more walls. They're not structural walls these times. They're police force, they're security cameras. They're different ways that we build walls to separate. So there is benefit. There's benefit when we work with a rootedness and a base in equity. But when you're looking at profit-driven motives, and you're looking at public-private partnerships, and you're looking at the kind of political milieu that we currently are in, not just in Baltimore, but in the country, well, and beyond the U.S., these kinds of politics don't embrace or offer equity. They continue inequality. I mean, we have the highest inequality in the country and ever that we've ever been able to measure. Doesn't mean it hasn't been similar, but that we've ever measured. We have politics that supports that. We have government processes that support that. We have government that believes the only way to rebuild our city is to bring in development, to bring in certain kind of development, to entice development with tax subsidies and benefits to them. But they don't look at, well, what's the equation? What's the equity and benefit for the public? And this is the public that's, you know, putting the dollars into the tax subsidies when you really trace where those benefits for the developer comes from. So we need that big picture, that kind of big picture of how does everybody benefit? How do we quit this separation, not just in a geographic spatial separation that the book talks about in East Baltimore, of one big conglomerate of a corporate university and a low-income majority of color disempowered community? How do we bridge that separation? And also, how do we bridge the gap in the inequality that occurs from that physical separation?
You write about the connection between disinvestment in the community, which you say has been going on for nearly 100 years, and the health of the residents. Tell us about that.
Right. So when we think about health, we usually think about health in a very narrow way. We think about health as genetic predisposition or biological variables that result in health. But in the last years, in the last 10 years, it's become more, there's been more understanding that there are social factors that result in our health today. So the more disinvested a community is, the less police presence, the more crime, the trash, the environment, these things have an effect on people's behavior and therefore people's health outcome. So if you don't have a good supermarket that offers healthy foods, fresh produce and veggies, you can't buy food that's healthy for you. You may buy a whole lot of starch that's less expensive that can result someday in you having diabetes. You know, this is a direct connection. So not having access to healthy nutrition in a community that's been disinvested and that the supermarkets leave out of fear means that now that community can't go next door or two blocks and get healthy produce. And the only things they can get are processed and packaged foods that are less expensive, canned vegetables that are less expensive. And over time, this has an effect on your health. So that's nutrition. Exercise is another one, right? If their infrastructure is not supported by government dollars, by tax dollars, people don't go out and exercise. You know, when you talk to residents, not just in East Baltimore, but in any community that's abandoned and don't have the resources for upkeep, if people, especially elderly, if they're walking down the street for exercise and there's no paved sidewalk or it's broken or they have to walk in the road, people won't exercise. I mean, there's lots of health research study that shows that this is an effect. If there's lots of crime and drug dealing in the community, people, as soon as it becomes dark, people won't get out on the street and walk. Well, when people get off work, that's the only time they may be able to get outside and exercise. So all these ways that disinvestment of a community doesn't allow for a healthy community, because the environment has a huge effect on our health outcomes. Not having access to resources, not having recreational centers so children can access after school activities that are healthy for them. If they just go home after school and there's nothing else to do, well, they may find themselves on the street. If you're living in a community that there's higher drug dealing, well, all of a sudden that becomes the status quo of what you see happens every day. So there are effects. You know, the disinvestment has a huge social impact in the community that someone lives in.
When you and I first spoke 8 years ago, you told me, quote, the success of the project will be measured by what impact it has on its residents, close quote. Today, how would you judge the success of EBDI?
I don't think they've been successful for several reasons. The first one is that they have not been included residents in part of the decision-making process. That's a big piece of continued oppression of people that has an effect on them. Today, their value, their worth, a sense of who I am. I'm not important enough to participate in how my community gets rebuilt, really. This is a continued message that people of color and low-income people have experienced in this country and this world. That's an effect on residents. So I find that to be a big outcome that we need to look at. What are people's sense of involvement and ownership of their community? So people have been expelled. that's one. The other one is their income. How has their access to resources grown? This needs to be measured. It's not sufficient for me to read that someone was able to get into a house that was 30 or 40 or 50,000 more than the house they were in, because as we know, many people who have been relocated into other homes that were of higher value than the ones they moved out of, they can't afford to keep the house up. They are spending more than 30%, much more than 30% of their income on a mortgage or on a rent. You've not increased that person's economic sustainability. You've not done anything for them as far as increasing their what we call supposedly upward mobility out of the place they're in. That's an effect on residents. And of course, just an effect on health, an effect on people's sense of are they having access to resources that make them not worry? Do they have access to nutrition? Are their children having access to better education? Again, these are things that we need to be better at. When we were organizing, we challenged EBDI that it wasn't sufficient to displace people, leave them out there, and just say, yeah, they're better now. What was going to be necessary was to do follow-ups, continue to follow up to find out how have this group of people who were forced to leave, how for this big project, how have they benefited? And not just 2 years after, but in the long term. This was something that we could never get a response on, I think, because no one knows. And I think the fear is that because we don't know, maybe there's not such good outcomes. We know a little bit more now with some of the moving to opportunity data that's occurred. It's a completely different project of rebuilding. This is that's a voluntary process where people are offered to move with vouchers, and they're having follow-up. But the small bit of information we've learned from some of the moving to opportunity projects across the country is that people's economic welfare doesn't necessarily increase. In fact, you think you move people into areas where there's greater employment, but they're not getting the jobs. They're not getting the employment opportunity that you say when you move into a higher income or a higher socioeconomic neighborhood you have access to. And this is data that's coming out of some of the moving to opportunity. In fact, I just saw some this weekend at the Eastern Sociological Society conference here in Baltimore. Some of the report out on that data out of Hopkins. So we need to look at these things. And this is what I mean about we need to be more cognizant and aware of the lessons that can be learned, not be fearful of what we find. It's only when we look and understand the information can we decide if we want to change it or not. But we have to be brave enough to look at it. We have to be courageous that we think that change is necessary.